580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest this afternoon is novelist Clyde Edgerton. We're speaking with him by phone in his home in North Carolina. Welcome, Clyde.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
We can hear you fine in spite of the cold weather in this part of the world. I do need to give a quick weather advisory. The temperature here in central Illinois and Indiana is 1 degree. There's a wind chill of minus 21 because of wind speeds of from 29 miles per hour with gusts up to 47 miles per hour. So there is a wind chill advisory for now until tomorrow morning about 9 o'clock. So drivers, be careful on the icy, snowy roads with that kind of wind. How warm is it in North Carolina?
Oh, I'm ashamed to say we've got the porch doors open and a little fire in the fireplace because it's cooling down from what was probably almost 70 degrees today. Probably all your listeners just turned off their radio.
I think they all got in their cars to drive to North Carolina. I should also explain that if my accent from my 12 years in North Carolina come back as I'm speaking to someone from that region of the country, my Midwestern listeners will, I'm sure, excuse me, but I can't hear a North Carolina accent without slipping back into that dialect. When you wrote The Bible Salesman, which came out just this last August, your latest novel, did you choose the period first? It's set in the 1950s with flashbacks to the 30s and 40s. Did you pick the period first, the character? How did you get into this book?
What happened maybe 3 to 4 years ago is that I received a phone call from Tom Franklin, a Mississippi writer. He and a Tennessee writer, a guy named William Gay, were putting together an anthology of stories which were supposed to be in some way a tribute to Flannery O'Connor. And they asked me, would I contribute? I said, sure. And I hung up the phone and I thought, what does that mean? How can I, what am I supposed to do? And I said, rather than call back, I'll just think about this. And two of my favorite characters for various reasons in literature are the Bible salesman from a story called Good Country People by Flannery O'Connor, and a character called the Misfit from another story called A Good Man Is Hard to Find. Many listeners may know those stories. Those two characters, I love those characters. And I said, well, why don't I write a story with a Bible salesman, not hers but mine, and with a criminal, not hers but mine. So I made up these two people and I put them together and wrote a short story in which the Bible salesman was quite conniving and mischievous and knew that he was mixed up with a criminal and felt okay about it. After finishing the short story, I liked the character so much, I then took on the novel. So I automatically had my time period. And it was convenient to me because I was 6 years old in 1950, and I have memories so that I felt like I could maybe move back. I heard so many family stories into the 30s, and so the period felt comfortable. And my plan was to take Henry from 1930 to 2000, but I never got past 1950.
So you have a character who's born in 1930 and is 20 in 1950 when the story begins. I might tell you, Clyde Edgerton, that I've been telling listeners for the last couple of weeks to pick up this book at the library or buy it and read it in preparation for this interview because I thought it would be fun for listeners who've read perhaps your other books or maybe this is their first book of yours they've encountered to actually get to talk to an author after they've just read one of his novels. So I am going to give the phone numbers, and listeners can call at any time. If they want to listen for a while first, that's fine, or if they want to call right in. The phone numbers are 833-9455 for listeners in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois area, where that's a local call. If it's a long-distance call, do use 1-800-222-9455. So, if you're listening on the Internet, if you're listening long distance, anywhere in the continental U.S., it's a toll-free call, 1-800-222-9455, or local callers, 333-9455, to talk with author Clyde Edgerton about his new book, The Bible Salesman. So you had this period, you had this character, and it sounds like from reading your acknowledgments that you're listening for interesting things from people you encounter, as well as, of course, relying on your own life experiences when you write. Is that accurate?
Altogether accurate, and I was so lucky. I usually am lucky in that while I'm working on something, I'll pick up a story or two or three or an incident that I can actually incorporate into what I'm writing. And on maybe 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, no, actually would have been, that would have made it four, less than, while I was working on the novel in any case a few years ago, I did a reading and a woman came up to me after the reading, I guess a sort of elderly woman. She said, I have a story I want to tell you. This is not unusual, and I always say, sure, but I'm not always sure of what the story's going to be. And she said, well, a neighbor of ours, I'll make this short, by the way, as I can. A neighbor of ours disappeared, an old woman disappeared the other afternoon, and we couldn't find her anywhere. We looked and looked and looked. We finally found her in her garden after hours and hours of searching. She had fallen and couldn't get up. She seemed not to be injured, and as we were getting her up, where she'd been sitting there for hours, I noticed her hands were dirty, and it turns out she had weeded as far as she could reach.
After she fell.
Yes. So I thought, I've got something I might can use, and she then told me another story about a friend who had a neighbor who's bought her mother a red dress, which brought out her mother's color and looked so nice on her mother. 6 months passed, and the mother dies, and the friend goes to the funeral, and the neighbor is standing by the open casket, and the friend walks up, and the mother is buried in the red dress. I'm so happy you buried her in that red dress. Said it brings out her color so well. Said, you know, they do get pale at a time like this. And then there was another story, which I'll stop now instead of keep. But it was a chain reaction. I told that story to someone else who told me a story of a woman showing a photograph, the only photograph that she had of her husband who had died. And the photograph was of him in a casket. And the friend said, do you have something a little less recent? So I took all three of those and found places for them in the novel and felt very fortunate to have that run. It's sort of like a miner finding a little vein of gold.
Your novels are often have great humor, but they also have tremendous poignancy and real sadness and deal with very important issues. I don't mean to, by talking about their humor, imply that they're not quite deep. I've appreciated both aspects. This novel also has quite a bit of violence, and when I was reading it, I was thinking how cinematic it was. Since you have had some of your novels made into movies, was that a conscious part of your mind that, this one might do too?
Actually, I didn't think of that beforehand. I did not think of that while I was writing, but I did think about it afterwards. Since I make a living this way, and something that can help when you're making a living writing is for a book to be made into a movie. And so I thought about it afterwards, and that it's always seems accidental when it happens. It has happened a couple of times for me, most recently with Killer Diller, which is on DVD. I might mention, not to get people to go out and get it, but I certainly wouldn't exclude that reason, but it never made it to the big screen. Although I think.
But Walking Across Egypt certainly did.
No, actually it didn't.
Oh, it did not.
Neither one of them did. Walking Across Egypt went straight to tape, and as did Killer Diller. Huh. But I'm certainly thinking about it. But I guess that comes from reading Conrad's advice to writers, which is and many other teachers and writers, including Flannery O'Connor. You want your reader to see. Conrad said that was more above all else important. He, in talking about that, gave a little list of things and said, but what's most important is for the reader to see. And certainly, Flannery O'Connor said if you have a newspaper boy, in her time it was a newspaper boy, selling newspapers, then the reader needs to see that newspaper boy, though unobtrusively, perhaps, within, you know, a short time. So I take those lessons to heart, and I want my reader to see what's going on, and I guess that helps give that a quality.
I don't want to spoil this book for readers who've not picked it up yet, but a couple things that reminded me of was, one, the bright colored aluminum kind of glasses with the turned out lip from the 50s.
Yes, boy, I can already tell you about how old you are.
Boy, could I see that.
You know, it's so funny that just popped into my head. I think I did have that in an earlier book, that particular glass. I mean, we had them in our house, and a cold drink couldn't get any colder.
I can remember feeling it against my lip in the summertime in Illinois.
Wonder what happened to those glasses. They probably had lead in them or something.
I suppose. That was wonderful. Another thing you enabled me to see quite well, and you've done this in others of your books, which I've appreciated, and that is life in Christian churches, particularly Baptist churches, and it's certainly not limited to the South. The Midwest is the Bible Belt as well, and I had experiences like these. But let me ask you about two particular ones that you mentioned in this book. One is a Bible sword drill, and the second is between the sheets. Now, those are things I remember well from my youth and teenage years. I'm not sure how much we can say even on public radio about the second, but tell us a little bit about those and why you thought that fit for this novel.
Well, you know, the sword drill was one of the last scenes written for the novel. Interestingly enough, I'm involved now in writing a one-hour Reader's Theater musical or Reader's Theater with music of The Bible Salesman, and I've been in that for the last 2 weeks with Michael Craver, a former Red Clay Rambler, having great fun with that. And one of the scenes, of course, we have only a few scenes in 1 hour, is the Bible sword drill, and people have responded to that in interesting ways. And as is true, of course, of Baptist culture, I can call it a shorthand, fundamentalist churches, and growing up in those churches among loving people and having experiences that people think are strange. Lottie Moon is a word that'll, you know, the Sunbeam song, the Royal Ambassadors, and interestingly enough, the organization, the Girls Auxiliary, and which tells you a little bit about the framework, the back in the 50s, probably still going, Royal Ambassador. Well, I'll get off of that. Back to the sword drill. Well, the fact is, you would stand at attention with a sword at your side, and someone would...
A Bible. Yeah.
A Bible, I'm sorry, a Bible at your side, and an adult usually would say, in our church, would say like Psalms 16:19, charge. Well, at the words charge, you snap to attention, pull open that Bible, and start looking for Psalms, the verse. When you found it, you put your finger on it and step forward. First person forward was called on, and if they got the scripture right, they won a point or something, or maybe a battle. And then whoever won the most battles won the war. You might
training for crusaders, right?
Yes, and it was a game, and it was. I did Google it when I was writing about it, and there are so many variations of it now, and there may always have been, but there seemed to be only one when I was back in church in my younger days. The other one, between the sheets.
Let me say a word just before you leave sword drills. In the independent church I grew up in, which later became a Baptist church, where my grandfather was the pastor, We did the sword drills when we were young, but when we got to be teenagers, it had become refined. And there was something, there was a version that had chairs that were wired to lights, and you'd sit in this chair. And as you, the first one to stand up, it would send off a light with your number on it so they could tell who was the first one to pop off their chair, who knew the answer to the question about a particular book in the Bible that, that was assigned for all these teenagers across the Midwest and maybe the South too, to memorize basically and be able to answer questions about. And people got so good. The young people were often very smart, very committed, and bright. And the question would be maybe three words out of the quiz master's mouth, and someone would be popping up to quote that Bible verse.
Wow! Yes, yes, I'm not surprised at all.
Interesting version, right? I couldn't help but think of that as I read your book.
Well, as you were explaining that, I couldn't help but think about Lee Smith's description of a church in
another
which
another wonderful Southern novelist.
There would be at the each Sunday morning down front would be a large board of light bulbs, and when you came, when your family came in, you screwed in your light bulb.
Wow.
So that at once you could look on the board and know who was not at church. Which reminds me of that little song, "Let Your Little," "This Little Light of Mine,"
yeah.
"I'm Gonna Let It Shine," and which reminds me of "Keep on the Sunny Side." We better slow down and stop and get back to Between the Sheets. What we can do on public radio, Between the Sheets is simply saying the name of a him and adding the words "Between the Sheets" to it, and you get as you would with any list of any songs, you get some almost if not pornographic, some soft porn kind of phrases there.
And teenagers would love to pass a hymnal back and forth.
With
the unstated adding of those phrases to the hymn that was open as that went down the row.
Exactly.
Right.
Find it and point to it and try to keep or try to make your person sitting beside you laugh during the service.
But Clyde Edgerton, now some of our listeners don't know how graphic some of the hymn titles are in Baptist hymnals. So I think we're going to have to give a few examples. "Rise Up, O Men of God," of course. "Love Lifted Me." I mean, I don't
That's
know how many.
My favorite. Oh, me. I'm afraid to hold back. The ones that are popping in my head, I'm
okay.
Careful.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about sex and morality with your main character, Henry. Is his last name pronounced Dampier?
Correct, Dampier.
Okay. Henry Dampier, he's we see him growing up, and we see him encountering sex along the way, as all young people do. And you have different parts of your book where you flash back to scenes in his growing up life and how he's learning about things like sex. Let's talk specifically about sex in the Bible. I don't want to give away some of your great punchlines in this book that are really just so funny, but he decides at first, in spite of what his aunt who raised him taught him to save sex till marriage, to look to have a sexual experience, or as he calls it, a sex relation, a great phrase, because he's reading the Bible. Tell us about that.
Well, he was raised not unlike I was raised, and that is with a belief that that the Bible is literal, that God wrote it, that if you don't believe every word of it, you're going to hell. Now, that's a powerful belief to have as a child. In many ways, it's powerful. One way it's powerful is it's hard to shake it loose. It's hard to shake it loose as you get older and because of fear. And so he's dealing with that, and he has been told what to read in his Sunday school quarterlies and otherwise, on his own, out on the road in these motels at night with his satchel full of Bibles, he starts reading, and he comes across For example, the story of Sarah and Abraham. And Sarah, unable to have a child, suggests and asks God about, I think, as I recall, Abraham maybe going to bed with their maid to have a child that way, which happens. And then they have a child and by the handmaiden. He has sex outside of marriage, and it's in the. We've just been working on this in the musical. I've got to tell you quickly how it goes. It's something like this. Henry reads this passage, which we quote, and Henry then thinks, I mean, what Sarah suggests is that he go in unto Hagar.
The old King James version of
yes, go in unto. So Henry says, go in unto. And then the music goes, go in unto. Abraham did it. Had a sex relation, and so forth.
Will too.
That's, well, we're going to rewrite next week. Get that line in there. That's so good. I can't believe I'm working on my musical on public radio. But that's a great. I think our next line is outside of marriage. Yeah. And blah, blah, blah. And I think that I will too. Is a, because when he does have an opportunity, he thinks about the Bible, as many of us still do in many ways, I tell you. And in writing this book, I had to jump ahead or off subject a little bit. I got involved, and I got obsessed with some biblical research and reading, translations, et cetera, because I had planned to take Henry up to 2000, and he was going to get involved in a big controversy. But when I realized I didn't need to go, I didn't have time to go beyond 1950, I had all this research left. And I had to do something with it, which is we may get on to the cats talking, which is how I use some of my biblical research. But I did have one. So basically, I couldn't use any research after 1950, but I knew about, because of a gift from a cousin, I knew about the Chicago Bible, the translations from the 20s and 30s by Edgar Goodspeed and these people up at Chicago, which used the Hebrew, oddly enough, for the Old Testament rather than the Greek. Apparently, the King James, you probably know more about this than I do. I'm sure you do. The King James Version gave a nod toward the Hebrew, but relied a good deal on the Greek, which was, of course, translated from the Hebrew. And so I stumbled on all kinds of interesting things in all my research and wanted to get it into the book somehow. And part of what I stumbled on was some of these fascinating stories from Genesis, some I knew about, some I'd forgotten about.
Like Tamar.
Yes. Tamar, or Tamar. Tamar, that story was, that's one that I knew about. It's a mind-boggling, incredible story. So, and the Bible's full of these stories.
But they don't tend to get read much in church.
No, they don't get read in church, and for obvious, I think obvious reasons, although it's all fascinating.
Well, let's continue talking about the Bible, since this is a show often on religion as well as on ethics and values and things like that. Your book, your novel probably quotes more from the Bible than any other novel I've read in the last decade or so, but in a fascinating way, and in a way that readers will certainly not find off-putting. They'll say, that's in the Bible, or they'll say, oh, that's a very interesting way to think about that in the Bible. But you talked earlier about having been raised in a fundamentalist Christian Protestant church, and you have this main character dealing with this, of snake handling even, you mentioned, speaking in tongues, just as a small comment, but showing the time. But you know, you have the boy at age 12, two boys raised in this subculture talking about masturbation and worrying about it in terms of what the Bible says or doesn't say, or at least their aunts or Sunday school teachers have told them it says about it. You have issues that that talk about how he tries to understand what the Bible means by reading it, and yet comparing that with what he's been taught, even trying to take it all literally. He gets so confused. Tell us a little bit about where that comes from.
Well, it comes from my life, my autobiography. And I try my biography. I was just thinking of a film which you may or may not have seen. Have you seen Dancing Outlaw?
No.
It's a series. It used to be a PBS series called, it was called A Different Drummer, Dancing Outlaw. If you Google Dancing Outlaw, you'll be able to see an amazing documentary. The ones since haven't been as good, I think, as the original one, but that's changing the subject. Somehow I got off on that. My biography includes... I use my biography as a tool whenever I can. It's dangerous for me to try to write fiction that draws from my own life because I have found in my particular experience that when I try to do that, usually the writing is fairly flat and not interesting. So I have to figure out ways to get at what I want to write about and in ways that, of course, aren't flat. But nevertheless, my biography includes concern and worries and fear around the whole issue of religion and the presence of God and Jesus. And so as I grew older, and now I'm even older than I used to be, I've gone through all kinds of, and still am, and will continue to, of questioning and wondering about this whole business of religion, and I've gone through kind of phases, one phase being a kind of a nitpicking, well, this contradicts this, and therefore, and I think it's okay to be at that stage, and people spend their lives studying and obsessed with scriptures and in ways that I can now understand. But that kind of nitpicking is something that I think can be a waste of time. Unless it's done in ways that help a person gain insight. I'm just now looking at this library, which is the Bible, a fascinating library, which, were it consistent, would be as dull as a book of theorems would be to me, that all come to the same kind of conclusion. So I'm looking at this book now in a completely different way. In fact, it's interesting that we did our little we've done our musical of the Bible Salesman, which lasts an hour once to an audience of eight, and we asked for comments afterwards. And one woman said, "Well, as soon as I heard that Bible stuff, I turned off. So uh-huh. I don't know anything about it, and I just completely turned off to it." And so we had a really interesting conversation after that with some of the other people, the other eight people, talking about what's going on. But nevertheless, all that comes from, you know, and each person, and what I'm hoping to do in the fiction is to tell a story and not write a book of reflections on Scripture. But the story provided me the opportunity to use my biography, which is where most of these concerns and wonderings come from, and discoveries. I mean, to read the 23rd Psalm, the last line, I'm not giving anything away here, I hope, but the last line that I grew up with was, "And shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." And then I find that in the Hebrew it was more like, "Dwell in the house of the Lord till an old age." And the difference in those two phrases is... infinity.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't have much more of a difference in meaning of two phrases, it seems to me. And the fact that that is that way just is fascinating. And then the whole business I discovered working on this book, the whole business of Thomas Jefferson's Bible, called Jefferson's Bible. I'm sure you know about that.
Yes. I've not read it, but I've read about it.
Yeah. Well, the reading about it is fascinating. And for those of us who know, have heard the New Testament over and over, the actual reading of it is very familiar. It just leaves in certain things and takes out certain things that reflected Jefferson's beliefs and interests in Jesus. And it's a fascinating document to read and read about, and in many ways helps me to feel comfortable with what I'm thinking presently. And then Ecclesiastes is mind-boggling in its flat stoicism, and rejection of any possibility of seeing into the future.
I want to get to talking about one of your great skeptical characters in the book, Uncle Jack, but we're about halfway through our program with a live interview by phone with Clyde Edgerton, the author of The Bible Salesman, published just this year, a novel by Little Brown, available in your bookstores and online, of course, published in August 08, highly recommended as one of, I guess, the 7 books of fiction by Christian Century magazine, out just last week. Did you know that, Clyde? It was your novel was highlighted by the Christian Century.
I think I saw a little paragraph, but it was more than a week ago.
Maybe 2 weeks ago.
Well, anyway, yeah, I did see something. I was very grateful for that.
Have you gotten other awards with this book yet, or is it
still
too new?
I've gotten some positive reviews, and people who look at reviews look at where it's reviewed. It's been reviewed in good places. Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and other places, and in Publishers Weekly, and the normal places. But it's gotten good coverage and good review, thanks in large part to my publisher, Little Brown, I think. They worked very hard.
And 5 of your previous novels have been on the New York Times Notable Books list.
So. That's correct. Yeah. They have been. This one wasn't, but the others have been, and things go like that. It would have been nice to have this one, but there are readers who it's interesting to get different responses to the novel, as it's true with any novel, and is this true with art in general?
We're about I need to take a short break.
Sure.
and let you take a chance to take a drink of water or whatever. This is WILL AM 580, broadcasting from Urbana, Illinois. Also found at 90.9 FM, HD2, and HD3 in Urbana, a broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois, a listener-supported broadcasting station, of course. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, I'll be traveling, and so we do have an archive program that'll be broadcast Sunday night. It's a interview with Professor James Wellman of University of Washington out in Seattle of his book, Evangelical versus Liberal, about the conflict, the political conflict between those two parts of the Christian church. So that's an archive program December 28th here on Keeping the Faith. Coming up in January, I'll be pleased to be interviewing some Muslim women about their life in America. In February, I'll be talking with Dean Michael Zimmerman from the Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis about a program where over 600 rabbis and ministers on one weekend in mid-February are celebrating evolution and Darwin's scientific contribution. That'll be in February, Dean Michael Zimmerman. In March, Robbie Jones will be my guest, talking about his book, Progressive and Religious. In March, theologian Donald McKim will be a guest here on Keeping the Faith. Those are some of the programs coming up ahead in the year ahead. Let me announce one local program. On New Year's Eve, The Chorale, directed by Julie Byler, will be performing at the Virginia Theater. It's a program that they have put on for the last 18 years that's quite popular in this area. The soloist will be Todd Payne, a wonderful baritone who got his doctoral degree here at the University of Illinois and is now a professor of music. And this is the one chorale concert per year that does charge admission, because the money goes for scholarships for young musicians to get to college, very talented musicians. We'll hear one of them at the Virginia Theater New Year's Eve. It's programmed at 7 o'clock. Tickets, $20 for adults, $18 for senior citizens and children. Go online to thevirginia.org. And you can find out also at the Chorale website, thechorale.org. That's New Year's Eve at the Virginia Theater. Dan Perino, local treasurer, will be directing the sing-along that night of very popular show tunes and things. So that's a local event here in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. But let's get back to our guest today. We're talking by phone in North Carolina to Clyde Edgerton, author of The Bible Salesman. Clyde, tell us where you're... What a fascinating character Uncle Jack is. Such a skeptic, such an interesting fellow who taught young Henry so many things, how to skin a rabbit and send him condoms in spite of some of the teachings that Henry was encountering about staying away from things like sex. And now let me give the phone numbers once more while you're thinking about that answer. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana for listeners, and elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. Clyde?
Yes, sir. Uncle Jack, and I guess in some ways comes from my Uncle Bob, an uncle who died 10 or 12 years ago. Oh, Lord, it was more than that. It was more like 18, 20 years ago. But I grew up really looking up to my Uncle Bob, who was quite the skeptic. We never talked religion much, but the fact that he went to drive-in movies on Sunday pretty much cast him as hell-bound. He lived in Ocala, Florida, and we'd go down to see him once a year at Christmas. And he was a quail hunter. And he wrote me letters some later in my life. And it's easy. I wasn't close to him. If I had lived closer to him geographically and perhaps had lived with him, I would have worshipped him or idolized him less than I did. But he's such that I've used him, his biography, his personality, and with several uncles and several characters throughout the series of novels I've written. So, and also, I guess I could lapse back into the parts of me that are skeptical, and let that go, and put that all with use all those traits as tools to make Uncle Jack.
Again, I don't want to spoil the book for people, but such lines as when Aunt Dory says, "Them boys need Sunday school," and Uncle Jack mutters, "Like a dog needs a spoon."
Yeah, yeah, Uncle Jack. I just heard about what happened in Sunday school class, little Henry is reporting. I guess that's when he was nine. I can remember all that because we're using some of these scenes in this musical, and we use that particular scene. Basically, we use Uncle Jack's response to that. And in fact, we're rewriting a scene as we speak. In fact, when you call, I was putting some words from another part of the novel into Uncle Jack's mouth there's an old fiddle player in the novel up at Indian Springs or Healing Springs who talks about hope and fear. And how their brothers, hope and fear are brothers, and there's good and there's bad in each of them. Of course, probably more good in hope than in fear, but he compares them to water and liquor. It says there's good and bad in each. Water can revive plants but rot wood, and liquor can rot marriages but revive storytelling. And the old fiddle player who is reported by Uncle Jack in the novel, I believe, becomes Uncle Jack in the musical. That's the kind of thing you have to do when you're going from one genre to another. So I've been actually working on that. And I love Uncle Jack. Uncle Jack and had problems not bringing him back without giving anything away. He's not throughout the whole novel, and I had a need to bring him back, but the book didn't call for that.
Now, you talk about creating this Reader's Theater, and although its first performance only had 8, since this program is picked up on the Internet all around, folks might see it somewhere. Where might it be performed next?
I think in Statesville, North Carolina, in January. We haven't decided the date. There's a little 80-seat theater in Statesville, North Carolina, And that'll be our first show probably in January. We're going to get it kind of put together. And after that, I'm not sure. I'll not be able to perform it as much as my right-hand musician, Mike Craven, so we'll probably find somebody else, and he and the other person will be able to perform it in different places, we hope.
And is it available to be picked up other places?
It will be eventually. Right now, it's just been put on paper. We're still writing it.
So Statesville can be considered off-Broadway.
That's correct. that's exactly correct. And we do have I do have Lunch at the Piccadilly has kind of been in production for, that's the last novel.
An earlier novel, yes.
Mm-hmm, and it's still being rewritten. It's been in workshop for a couple of summers, and we're hoping to get that put together here. I'm supposed to be working on the second act of Lunch at the Piccadilly, and we're not sure where that will be going, but it's been performed in the Southeast a bit during these last two summers. It's fun to go from one medium to another. It's fun to work on these plays. I think I learn a good bit from having to have an audience and present something. And on the one hand, on the other hand, having a reader who's sitting under a lamp on a couch with a mind that can be patient and wander around. An audience is very much different. There's less patience, I think.
How do you balance family life, writing novels, short stories, working on plays, enjoying your music, and teaching writing?
Well, I get up very early and I go to bed very early. I have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 2-year-old. And when they go to bed about 7:30, I'm often in bed by 8:30, and up by 5:30 if I can do that, around about there, and work for an hour or so, two. And I get things done that way. Otherwise, it's very hard to accomplish and to get these things done that you mentioned. But it's very pleasing and satisfying to be able to have them and to have the hope that they will get done. And so I squeeze things in, and I hope I can get at least one thing done fairly well and the other things halfway. And my main objective is to write good novels. And I'm working on one now about seven white boys in 1963 who try to memorize James Brown's album Live at the Apollo and perform it on television. So that's what I'm in the middle of now.
You've taught at Duke and University of North Carolina, where you are presently at Wilmington. Tell us about what student writers are like these days, potential writers.
Sure. And I'll put in a plug for UNC, University of North Carolina at Wilmington, where I teach. We have a really fine MFA program, and I think it's really fine because of the faculty and because of our program. It's a 3-year program, postgraduate program for a terminal degree in creative writing. An MFA, we work with in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And students in fiction have to take nonfiction and poetry classes. And the students are excellent. But we've sort of gotten into the national competition on getting students to come here for our MFA program. Iowa is still at the top, I would think, or guess. I don't keep up with all that much. But we get over 300 applications a year for about 20 positions. And thus, we now have, this program has been in existence for about 10 years. And the last 5 years or 4 years, this book has gained in popularity and exposure. And so we have young people coming in here, many married couples, some with children, and other people are anywhere from 22 to 32 on average, but we have people older than that in our program. And it's a great experience. They write really well. And one of my jobs is to get them to follow no advice, which does not make sense to them. That's my first line of advice.
To follow what kind of advice?
Follow no advice.
Which
does not make sense.
I see. Okay.
To them. Because I think it's easy to get among people you think know more than you do and just automatically do what they say. And So I try to stress that. But your question was to the talent of writers. They're very talented, and we have.
What kind of questions do they ask? What are they trying to do these days?
They're concerned about technique, technical problems, the same old problems. Once you get down into a workshop and you start working on a piece of fiction, generally 12 people sit around a table, 12, 15 people. One of them has given the others a piece of work to take home for a week and critique. A couple of them have, actually. And then during 3 hours each week, we sit and we spend a while talking about each one of them as if the writer were not there. And so we end up talking about point of view. Whose story? What is the story about? And once we decide what it's about, we've got to talk about if it's interesting and if it's worthy of being told, and try to find out what the writer's doing. Then we have the writer see and observe during this conversation about his or her work what might be not working so well and what seems to be working well. So it's a craft kind of thing that happens weekly. And then their courses are being taught about the history of the form of the short story and what kind of problems have been encountered, what's conventional. And so that's a little bit about what goes on.
In your current novel, The Bible Salesman, that we've been talking about this afternoon, you talk about Jesus said, love your enemies, but God killed a lot of them. Henry Dampier says at one point, you talk about Jesus was perfect, even though he cursed a fig tree and cursed the folks selling in the temple. And I would add, was also disobedient to parents at age 12.
Right.
Where are you with your faith at this point, if you're willing to share that?
I'm willing and unwilling. I'm only unwilling because I don't think I could enunciate it very well, which is a poor excuse for not saying. I'm somewhat of a skeptic. On the one hand, I'm like Uncle Jack. On the other hand, I'm like Thomas Jefferson, I think. I think what Jesus had to say is revolutionary and very important. For one reason, it's about our neighbors, and so I'm interested in how we treat and think about our neighbors locally and nationally and internationally. I think that's a big message which makes a difference in the world that we live in, and it becomes therefore religious and theological, and I cannot believe in the Bible literally. My mind does not allow me to do that. So there are these tensions that come about as a consequence of my upbringing, which other people wouldn't have if they weren't raised the way I was. So I find a certain camaraderie with some of those people who remember the good music of the church they grew up in and remember the loveliness of the people and the caring of the people. And I've just read an editorial today about conservatives, for example, giving more to charity, et cetera, than do liberals. I don't know if you caught that or not in New York Times today.
I didn't see that, no.
It's an interesting article that is a consequence of research, but that's off the subject a little bit. So that's an overview of kind of what I deal with. How I treat my children and my family and my neighbors is very important. And I think Jesus was interested in that, what we have of what he said. I am skeptical, as was Thomas Jefferson, to read the detail, you can go to his Bible, about where and how the stories of Jesus came about and what the stories were used for politically to gain followers, apparently, which is human nature. There is something revolutionary and important there that I find interesting and worthwhile and important in a life and death way. Because when you talk about family and neighbors and caring for people, you're talking about life and death. But I tend not to talk about heaven and hell very much because I don't know how to talk about that.
What about cats talking?
Well, ironically enough, I can't talk about cat heaven and hell, but I can have cats talk in my fiction. So these cats, I ended up with this novel with all this information, all this stuff I just touched on, like, let me ask you this. Did you read Yahweh and Jesus, The Name's Divine?
No. I saw you mentioned it in your acknowledgments.
I did, and I highly recommend that. Okay. It's a fascinating book that got me thinking about all kinds of things. But I had read some about the political business around the birth of Christ before and after, and how Christians and Jews early on were clearly unhappy with each other, and the reasons why they might be unhappy with each other, and it's fascinating. So I had all that, but I had this book which was ending in 1950, and there's no way I could use any of my readings and research, so I just put some of that stuff in the mouths of cats and let them talk through some of that. And I had about 20 pages in the early drafts, and my editor read it and said, "What in the world are you doing?" She said, "I have no idea what this is about." And I said, "Well, can I keep just a little bit of it?" She said, "Okay." So I kept some of it, and they're singing songs in our musical, those cats are.
Well, it's a wonderful little section, and intimating that maybe the weird woman who has all these cats is throwing her voice, but it's all, you're never sure. And it's a fascinating little section, or a couple sections. Stall for here a second. I see we have a call coming in. Let me give the numbers for other callers who in our last 6 or 7 minutes would like to join us. 333-9455 is the local number, and 1-800-222-9455 is the toll-free number. Line number one, yes, you're on the air with our guest, Clyde Edgerton.
Hello.
Hi there.
I enjoyed your book.
Thank you for reading it.
I listened to Steve, and I went right straight to the library.
Always a good thing to do.
Exactly. So I remember earlier in the discussion you were saying to write in a way where you can see what you're reading, I think.
Correct. You want your reader to be able to see the action.
Yeah.
Given the kind of fiction that I write. Now, that certainly wouldn't be true in a lot of kinds of writing and even a lot of types of fiction.
Yeah, I thought you did a fabulous job with that. And I'll tell you what, I still see that old lady driving, having to drive the car.
Yes.
To take him to his, this novel is going to take a whole different turn. I don't know what in the world this woman's doing behind the wheel of the car. And is there something more to say about those old people?
Well, I grew up, a little hint there. My mother was 40 when I was born. She had two sisters, one a little older, one a little younger, who were childless. So it was as if I were raised by three grandmothers.
Wow.
They just kind of doted on me, and I had 23 aunts and uncles.
Mm.
And because my parents were older, they were quite older. So I grew up among old people, and I heard old women talk a lot. And I absorbed that, not knowing that it might come back one day in novels. So I enjoy my book, Walking Across Egypt. The second one is about one elderly woman, the whole book, and then Lunch at the Piccadilly is about a nursing home.
Mm.
So I'm used to writing. I can always kind of just fall back and write about old people and have fun doing it.
Well, I loved her spiritedness. I loved her independence. I thought it was just great.
Well, thank you.
I'm glad. Thank you.
I try not to step on toes. To be irreverent about old people.
No.
People started telling me nursing home jokes when they heard I was writing a story about a nursing home, and I had to just, some of them were inappropriate, but I'll tell you quickly one that was appropriate that I liked. It's supposed to be true about, it was about Billy Graham in a nursing home, and he talked to a woman in the lobby for about 20 minutes, and finally he said, "Do you know who I am?" And she said, "No, but there's a nurse down at the end of the hall. It can tell you who you are."
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Sure, bye-bye.
We're happy to squeeze in another caller if someone wants to make that call. And in the meantime, I'll tell you a real quick story from Pittsboro, North Carolina, when I was there. as a pastor of the Presbyterian Church, a little very small church, center aisle, and one of the older women at one point was telling other women right before the service about her shed had been broken into and a chainsaw stolen. And she one of the other women said, "Well, I suppose we just need to pray for that thief." And this wonderful older lady named Sankey Reed said, "Yeah, pray he cuts his leg off."
Oh, that was a church where probably Doris Betts attended, another great writer.
Unfortunately, after I had left, but she's a friend, and we've interviewed her on this program before. She's a great writer as well.
I learned a lot from her. I went to a workshop before I ever was published, and took notes, and those notes I still teach to my students. She was an excellent teacher of writing and a great writer.
She taught at Chapel Hill for years and years. Mm-hmm. That's right. We're down to our last minute, talking with Clyde Edgerton, author of The Bible Salesman, and of a Reader's Theater musical that may come. Does it have a name? Will it be called The Bible
Salesman?
It'll
be called The Bible Salesman. We're calling it Pizza Theater, a new kind of theater. This can be done in a home. It's about an hour long. It has music with it. And in Reader's Theater, you, of course, traditionally use scripts, so it's read aloud and has music with it.
And your other production that's sort of on the road, tell us about that as we end here.
Lunch
at the Piccadilly.
It's a play and a novel, and we're hoping to get the play. We're cutting from 9 characters to 6 so that professionals can do it. That's the sad thing about theater. Community theater, you can use as many people as you want to in your cast, but when you try to get it touring with professionals, you have to cut way back so they can afford to do that.
It's expensive.
So we're cutting it from 9 to 6 now. It's not a very literary thing to talk about, but that's what we're doing.
Well, let me thank you again for being our guest for this long hour, this close to the holiday season. And Clyde Edgerton has been our guest. Thanks to our caller and to others who I know have read the book and were eager to listen to this program about the Bible Salesman. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for Keeping the Faith. Let me remind people that next week we'll be having an archive program with Professor James Wellman of the University of Washington in Seattle, talking about politics in terms of evangelical versus liberal. And again, a reminder about the Chorale program in Champaign-Urbana, directed by Julie Byler, New Year's Eve at the Virginia Theater, 7 p.m. Tickets will be available at the door and can be found at online, thevirginia.org, or at thechorale.org online. $20 for adults. Todd Payne will be the baritone soloist, and one of the music scholarship recipients from the past will be performing. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Subdivisions, industrial parks, strip malls, gridlock. Sprawl is socially unequal, environmentally irresponsible, and aesthetically ugly, right? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll look at the cost and, yes, the benefits of suburban sprawl. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7.
On Monday's Afternoon Magazine, a look at Chechnya's wars and the toll the years of violence has had on its children. I'm Tom Rogers. At 106, Celeste Quinn's guest will be journalist Ajni Sierstad. Her first trip to Chechnya was in 1995. In 2006, she returned and lived with orphans in Grozny. The Afternoon Magazine runs Monday through Friday here on AM 580, beginning at noon Central Time.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Prospect Bank, coming soon at the corner of Prospect and Kirby in Champaign. Dick O'Neill and the team at Prospect Bank are committed to providing Champaign-Urbana with a fresh perspective on banking. Information at theprospectbank.com. Member FDIC. Prospect Bank is a division of Edgar County Bank and Trust.
This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.